This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know around here we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. Trying to untangle this economy one indicator at a time. That is what we are about. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Tuesday today, the 16th of May. Good as always to have you along, everybody. We are going to begin today with a simple statement of economic fact. Spending by or on behalf of consumers drives 70% or more of this entire economy. And I offer that both as a setup for and a mea culpa for what I'm about to say, because I know we've been concentrating a lot on consumers of late. We got retail sales for April this morning, up 0.4% from March, which is good. And yet, the bump wasn't as much as people were guessing it would be. People are dining out more, for instance, but we're all cutting back on big ticket items like appliances. You roll that in with the day-to-day hubbub, like rising credit card debt and delinquencies, yet airlines have record-breaking bookings. There is a certain cognitive dissonance. Marketplace's Kristen Schwab is on the Mixed Economic Messages desk for us today.
If you find the moody ups and downs of all these incremental economic data points confusing, well, you're not alone. Joanne Hsu directs the survey of consumers at the University of Michigan.
I think everyone finds it confusing.
See, we're all in this together, which I guess is both comforting and scary. And that kind of describes people's sense of the economy. Some are worried about the job market, but not necessarily their own job. And plenty are concerned about inflation, so they might put off buying, say, a new stove. But ooh, look, sushi.
People's attitudes have not always completely squared with what their spending patterns look like. All of these data points are different slices of the consumer experience.
Between the pandemic and its economic ripple effects, the consumer experience has been a wild ride. And Jessica Ramirez, a retail analyst at Jane Holly & Associates, says people are reacting to that.
You know, if you can enjoy a night with a friend or if you can enjoy a moment out, it seems to be the priority.
Ramirez says many people are still making up for lost time. There's pent-up demand for services, dinners out, baseball games, vacations. Meanwhile, demand for goods is lower because people overbought while stuck at home.
You can only buy so many electronics and one of each for your kitchen.
Sales of big ticket items are what economists usually watch as a barometer for what consumers feel they can afford. But economist Mark Zandi at Moody's Analytics argues that maybe we need to, at least temporarily, reconsider our normal barometers of the economy.
You know, it never has gotten quite back to normal. Because maybe normal's different, right?
And in that way, the mixed messages coming in maybe make sense.
You add it all up and it's a consumer that's, you know, hanging in there, doing their part.
Doing their part, one spicy tuna roll at a time. I'm Kristen Schwab for Marketplace.
Wall Street on this Tuesday. Love me a spicy tuna roll, by the way. Those retail sales numbers did not do traders' confidence any good at all. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Our artificial intelligence came to Capitol Hill today. The CEO of the company that introduced ChatGPT to the world spent some time in front of a Senate Judiciary Subcommittee. Sam Altman, who runs OpenAI, that's the company, talked up the great potential of artificial intelligence. But he also said, and I am quoting here, if this technology goes wrong, it can go quite wrong. Congress doesn't exactly have the best track record when it comes to proactively regulating emerging technologies, looking at you, social media. So we asked Marketplace's Matt Levin to look into whether this time could be different.
Sometimes it feels like Congress is better at creating memeable soundbites about tech than creating tech-savvy regulations. Remember this?
The internet is not a big truck. The internet is a series of truths.
That's the viral remix of how former Alaska Senator Ted Stevens characterized the internet back in 2006. There were no series of tubes moments in today's hearing on AI, which I suppose bodes well. But former Federal Trade Commission lawyer Charlotte Slayman says Congress is always going to be at a disadvantage in tech expertise.
Congress is responsible for everything. They are absolute generalists, and that's why we have regulators.
Creating an AI-specific cabinet department was an idea floated at today's hearing, as were licenses for developing AI models and AI accuracy scorecards. Slayman says unlike the early days of the internet and social media, both Democrats and Republicans seem more receptive to the idea for federal intervention.
I think the bipartisan interest in addressing these problems is a special opportunity.
It's cliche to say, but tech almost always does move faster than public policy, although Daryl West at the Brookings Institution says there is one relatively recent example where the U.S. got its act together pretty quickly.
As soon as nuclear power came around, there was widespread agreement that we couldn't just leave this to private companies. We needed a very strong regulatory agency that could step in.
Wes says he's optimistic the U.S. could replicate that path with AI, but the type of global cooperation we saw in the 20th century on, say, nuclear weapons?
It seems impossible for the United States, Russia, and China to agree on anything.
Wes says that's going to be more complicated. I'm Matt Levin for Marketplace.
Judging by today's debt limit meeting at the White House, we are still a long way from anywhere on a deal over Republican demands for budget cuts in return for not defaulting on the full faith and credit of the United States. There are a whole lot of moving parts in this thing, obviously, but one item that keeps coming up on House Republicans' list of demands, in fact, today Speaker Kevin McCarthy called it a red line, is work requirements to be eligible for some federal assistance programs. The GOP is not alone in pushing this idea. There's a handful of private businesses, government contractors, to be clear, that is also advocating for it. And as Marketplace's Chrissy Clark, the host of our podcast, The Uncertain Hour, reports, those companies are making a whole lot of money enforcing those work requirements.
Shareholder earnings calls are not the most edge-of-your-seat listening, unless you know what to listen for.
Greetings, and welcome to the Maximus Fiscal 2018 first quarter conference call.
Like this call for a multinational, multi-billion dollar company called Maximus. It's one of a few for-profit companies that run government welfare-to-work programs across the country. The CEO, Bruce Caswell, made more than $6 million last year. And on this call in 2018, he told shareholders things were looking up because they were at the vanguard of what he called a movement.
If you think about what's being called welfare reform 2.0 domestically, and the movement to add work requirements, not just to the Medicaid program, but other programs like the food stamp program and other similar programs. It's a competency that no other company in the market has, like Maximus.
Maximus was largely built on the idea of putting work requirements into welfare programs. The company went public the year after welfare reform 1.0 was passed in 1996. And since then, work requirements are a policy Maximus and similar firms have tried to shape, perpetuate, and grow. They've spent millions of dollars in lobbying and political donations.
We changed the whole dynamic of welfare to work in this country.
Peter Cove is the founder of AmericaWorks, one of the nation's first for-profit welfare-to-work companies. He says he was closely involved in the push to add work requirements to cash welfare in the 1990s and helped convince policymakers to allow for-profit companies to run programs.
As a private for-profit company, we had a bottom line. And so we said, if we don't succeed, we go out of business. That's not true of government.
Peter says he sees his company as having two main customers: governments, who pay him for enforcing work requirements, and local employers, who his company helps fill jobs with people on welfare.
What we basically say to government is, we will charge you for getting someone off welfare and a job and staying in a job. And to the private sector, we say, we're going to bring you a worker who's going to save you a lot of money.
Government is one of your customers. Businesses are another. What about the welfare recipient?
I think of them more as the product of our company rather than customers.
So people are the products?
Well, there are, I mean, yeah, of course. I mean, they're inventory for us. They're our raw product. They come in and we have to do something with them. A terminology may bother some people, but that's in fact what we do.
How much do you make off your inventory, off of your products?
We make enough to stay in business. Our revenue runs between $40 and $50 million a year.
But what are taxpayers getting for all that money? I ran Peter through some of the results we found in our analysis of data we obtained from the state of Wisconsin. AmericaWorks, Maximus, and other for-profit welfare-to-work companies each take in millions of taxpayer dollars from the state each year to enforce work requirements and connect participants with jobs. But in the last few years in Wisconsin, the median wage for people who got jobs on welfare has hovered around $11 an hour, which, even if you are working full time, would put you below the poverty line for a family of three. And our investigation showed only about a third of the welfare participants who these companies considered ready to work even got jobs that lasted more than a month. What do you make of that?
What do I make of that? That we're not doing as well as I would hope we would be doing. That I would hope that we would be getting more people into jobs.
But even if private welfare-to-work companies are not getting that many people into jobs, let alone jobs they can support a family on, these companies still get paid by the state. For every person that just walks into an AmericaWorks office in Wisconsin and says, "Hi, I need help," the company takes in money. Last year, Wisconsin paid AmericaWorks almost $5 million for managing about 2,000 welfare cases, assigning participants required work activities, making sure they were doing them for the required number of hours, and docking their benefits if they weren't.
I'm a big dollar sign for them.
Maya Miller is from Racine, Wisconsin. She first turned to welfare right after she'd had a baby. The low-paying daycare job she'd had for years until then didn't have paid maternity leave, so welfare helped her make ends meet in those early newborn days. And like a lot of women I've talked to, when the program's work requirements kicked in on her case, they felt like meaningless hoops to jump through. So she left welfare for another low-paying daycare job she found on her own, and she felt trapped.
You don't have enough to survive. You're pending pension all over again. You're living paycheck to paycheck. You're basically worse off, you know, than from where you came.
But even though Maya had found her new job on her own, even though it was barely enough to support her son on, the for-profit welfare-to-work company where she was enrolled, a company called ResCare, got thousands of dollars from the government as a reward for the fact that Maya had gotten that job. And when Maya found that out, she was mad.
I'm making your company money and I need somebody to assist me. And I wasn't receiving that. It really got under my skin to know that they would get allocated more money based upon my participation versus actually me getting the services or something that I really could gain from.
We reached out to the private company that managed Maya's welfare case, ResCare, which recently changed its name to Equus. It declined an interview but said in a statement it's, quote, dedicated to assisting welfare participants gain access to employment. We also reached out to Maximus, the company that said in that earnings call that work requirements are a major competency. A company spokesperson said in a statement that Maximus doesn't design policies, it just implements them.
As for Maya, the person who went through Wisconsin's privatized welfare-to-work system, she says she wishes more welfare money went directly to struggling families like hers, rather than paying private companies to enforce work requirements and try to get people jobs that often keep them in poverty. I'm Chrissy Clark for Marketplace.
The whole new season of The Uncertain Hour about the welfare-to-work industrial complex is out now. You can get it at marketplace.org. Coming up.
I've seen somebody give away the fluff from inside an old couch.
Hey, any takers? First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials off 336 points today, 1%, 33,012. The NASDAQ shed 22 points, nearly 0.2%, 12,343. The S&P 500 gave back 26 points, about 0.2%, 41.9 there. Capital One added 2% today after it came out that Warren Buffett's Berkshire Hathaway had taken a stake of almost $1 billion in that bank. Biopharma giant Amgen dipped 2.4% today after the Federal Trade Commission sued to block its acquisition of drug maker Horizon Therapeutics. That is a deal that would be worth $27.8 billion. Horizon tumbled about 14.1%. Bond prices fell today. Thanks for asking. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 3.54%. You're listening to Marketplace. With access to so much information, it's hard to feel like an informed, discerning citizen. That's why on Make Me Smart, which is a podcast from Marketplace, we make it easy for you to stay in the know. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I unpack the latest from Washington, D.C.
The Senate Minority Leader has announced that he will step down as the Republican leader.
What's happening in AI? I mean, don't buy at the top, but holy cow, artificial intelligence and all the companies related to it are the hot new thing. And we do the numbers.
So as a refresher, inflation is the rate of increase in the prices of things. It's not just sort of things getting more expensive. It's the speed at which things get more expensive.
Because in a world that's constantly changing, we all need to stay smart. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Two data points with which to set up this next story. Number one, ticker symbol HD closed off a bit more than 2% today. Home Depot at one point had been down almost twice as much. And related, number two, just 21% of adults in this economy think now is a good time to buy a house. That is according to Gallup today. It is a record low, and in fact, it's just the second time in 40 years that less than half of Americans have said it's a good time to buy a house. The first time was last year. And this is a tough time for a lot of people to buy. Mortgage rates and prices are high, inventory is low, affordability is lacking, and the lack of people buying does not happen in an economic vacuum, as Marketplace's Sam Fields reports.
When people buy a new home, they often buy all sorts of other things.
Home furnishings, appliances, and then, of course, technology, whether it's new televisions or new security systems or surround sound.
So Natalie Cutler at the accounting and advisory firm BDO USA says when home buying slows down,
there really is a ripple effect.
Today's retail sales numbers showed people spent less on furniture, appliances, building materials, and garden supplies in April than they did a year ago. Home Depot also reported today that sales dropped in the first quarter and said it's not expecting the rest of the year to be great either.
The state of the real estate market is kind of flowing through to some of those major retail chains.
Katie Thomas at the Kearney Consumer Institute says it's important to remember, though, that this is coming after an unusually strong few years for companies like Home Depot that really benefited from all the home improvement projects people did during the height of the pandemic.
Nothing's falling off a cliff yet. You're just seeing a little bit of a stabilization from the pandemic.
There are other things going on in the economy right now, too, that are making people pull back, says Lydia Boussour, senior economist at EY Parthenon.
That includes elevated inflation, the fact that credit has become more expensive and more difficult to access. And at the same time, the labor market is turning less supportive.
So it's not just that fewer people are buying and selling homes. And actually, Kevin Erdman at the Mercatus Center at George Mason University says it's not all bad news in the housing market even.
The actual construction of new homes, the actual rate of completion of homes each month really hasn't declined at all.
Home builders are busy, and we learned today they're actually getting more confident with every passing month. I'm Samantha Fields for Marketplace.
There's been a whole lot on the program today about buying and selling. Retail sales from Kristen, real estate just now from Sam Fields. But there are corners of this economy where goods change hands, but money doesn't. See also buy nothing groups. You got something you don't want? Take a picture, list it on your local group. Somebody is going to want it. No money allowed, ever. But just because money and, in a sense, capitalism aren't directly involved, doesn't mean they're not right nearby. Wahini Vara is a contributor at Wired, where she wrote most recently about buy nothing groups. And question number one, when we talked, was how she found out about them in the first place.
I learned about buy nothing through my mom, who for a long time lived in the Seattle area where buy nothing got started. And she does much of her acquisition and getting rid of things on buy nothing.
And when you say you can ask for or give away anything you don't necessarily want, you actually mean anything, right? Just to sort of set the stage here.
Yes. Like, it's very common for people to put like rocks from their yard on buy nothing. In my town's Buy Nothing group, people have given away like a half-eaten pizza. Yes, like truly, truly anything you can imagine has been gotten or given away on Buy Nothing.
Okay, so with that as background, give me sort of the 30-second version of this long and it's a complicated story that you wrote in Wired about Buy Nothing and how it started and sort of where things wound up.
Yeah. So Buy Nothing was started by these two women from Bainbridge Island, Washington, Liesl Clark and Rebecca Rockefeller, who came together and were like, you know what, let's start a local Facebook group in Bainbridge Island, our community. Basically, it blew up. It got so big that they ended up helping other communities nearby start their own Buy Nothing groups. And eventually, within like really just a couple of years, it became this national phenomenon and then this worldwide phenomenon where there were Buy Nothing groups on Facebook. And they started to feel, in part because of things that were happening in the wider world, like around 2016, 2017, 2018, like there was something that was a bit dissonant about their presence on Facebook, mm-hmm. which is this very corporate platform. It was all supposed to be this community where everything was about doing things outside of the money economy.
Right. And the dissonance makes sense, right? Launching on Facebook, this platform that's about as acapitalistic as you could probably ever want to get.
Absolutely. Exactly. They tried various efforts to get off of Facebook. They first started to like try to fundraise within their community. But then some people in their community were upset about that, understandably, because the community was supposed to be all about not doing things involving money. And so then they scrapped that idea and decided to start like essentially raising funding from investors.
One of them wrote to venture capitalists, right? I mean, they went
exactly.
All in.
Like many, many venture capitalists, right. Like upwards of 100 investors to try to get money for this thing. They went all in. And a couple of things happened, one of which was that this did not go over well with some members of their community who ended up experiencing like this big backlash. And also because of what the roots of their community were, they weren't able to sort of like raise the early funding that would have allowed them to create like this really great, robust app. And so they ended up both with this app that like was not very good and a community that was pissed off, which was a troublesome outcome for them.
Which is also not good. Why do you think in the final analysis this whole thing has proved to be so difficult, because this is really a story. I mean, all the twists and turns in this story are one obstruction and obstacle after another for these two women trying to do buy nothing.
Yeah, I mean, I think part of what I took away from it is that capitalism is very entrenched in our everyday lives, and our lives are very entrenched in capitalism. It's really hard to disentangle the two. And so, yeah, I mean, you have here a lot of idealistic people, I think, trying to do something positive in the world. And yet capitalism was there all along. It just wasn't as apparent to the people involved.
Right. Is your mom still a diehard buy-nothing-er?
She is, although I have to say my mom moved from the Seattle area to Colorado where I live and ended up later joining our Colorado group. Oh. And in as part of this big controversy over Buy Nothing becoming a company, my local group was one of many that ended up splitting from the Buy Nothing community. And so they have a totally different name now. My mom is a member of that group and like is sort of like distancing herself a little from my reporting on this topic.
Right. And therein lies the whole story, right?
Exactly.
There you go. Joaquin Ybarra writing in Wired magazine. It's a piece called The Battle for the Soul of Buy Nothing. Check it out. It's totally fascinating. Joaquin, thanks a lot. I appreciate your time.
Thank you.
This final note on the way out today, in which patent and trademark law once again proves endlessly fascinating. For 34 years, a small-ish chain of taco restaurants has held a trademark for branding and advertising on the phrase Taco Tuesday. Well, today, Tuesday, as it happens, the much larger taco chain Taco Bell filed a petition with the Patent and Trademark Office to cancel said trademark because, the company says, the phrase Taco Tuesday should be freely available to all who make, sell, eat, and celebrate tacos. All right, we are going. Here, though, is your moment of economic context. Actually, it's a quick nod to the politics of this economy. President Biden is going to Japan tomorrow for the G7 Friday and out into the weekend. It was supposed to be a 7-day trip, but he's coming home Sunday because of the whole debt limit thing. 16 days until the 1st of June, if you're counting, which we are. Our digital and on-demand team includes Carrie Barber, Dylan Mietten, and Janet Wynn, Olga Oxman, Ellen Rolfes, Virginia K. Smith, and Tony Wagner. Francesca Levy is the executive director of digital and on-demand. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM. With access to so much information, it's hard to feel like an informed, discerning citizen. That's why on Make Me Smart, which is a podcast from Marketplace, we make it easy for you to stay in the know. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdal. Every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I unpack the latest from Washington, D.C.
The Senate Minority Leader has announced that he will step down as the Republican leader.
What's happening in AI? I mean, don't buy at the top, but holy cow, artificial intelligence and all the companies related to it are the hot new thing. And we do the numbers.
So as a refresher, inflation is the rate of increase in the prices of things. It's not just sort of things getting more expensive. It's the speed at which things get more expensive.
Because in a world that's constantly changing, we all need to stay smart. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.